NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Tuesday, September 26th. Did you see the op-ed in the New York Times yesterday by sociologist and former Bernie Sanders advisor Nick Hilgoyle called America Pulled Children Out of Poverty? Now it's set to reverse course with a vengeance. Here is Bernie Sanders on the topic with CNN's Jake Tapper last week.
You know, Jake, take a deep breath. We're talking about the head of General Motors making $29 million a year. We're talking about the rich getting richer. And yet we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth. What a disgrace.
So Nick Hilgoyle was a Sanders advisor on children and education. And his New York Times op-ed is linked to a new book by him called Live to See the Day, Coming of Age in American Poverty. And just to get our priorities straight, if we can't solve child poverty in this richest country probably in the history of humanity, where are our priorities? Nick Hill, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
To start on the news, as your op-ed does, how did we recently pull children out of poverty?
The census recently put out their annual poverty report for year 2022, and they found that within just 1 year, the child poverty rate more than doubled, which means that more than 5 million children were plunged back into poverty. It is the largest single largest increase in recorded American history. And it is due to the expiration of the child tax credit and among other pandemic-related economic programs.
Yeah, and I think our listeners, a lot of our listeners know at least a little bit about the expanded child tax credit during the pandemic and that Congress let it die. But let us in on some detail of how it worked, since you know it at that level. And it wasn't just the child tax credit during the pandemic that contributed to this drop in child poverty, right?
Sure. You know, it's quite remarkable to think about the history over just the past couple of years, where both President Donald Trump and President Biden have enacted trillions of dollars of spending that have dramatically reduced poverty, and particularly child poverty. You can start with the economic impact payments, the stimulus checks, the expanded unemployment insurance, and then finally the expanded child tax credit. But you can also look at the variety of social programs, from the expansion of SNAP benefits to the emergency rental assistance to expansion of Medicaid. It is just remarkable the spree of programs that have strengthened American families and children over the past couple of years. And, you know, I started at the Senate the day the American Rescue Plan was voted on through by the Senate. And that piece of legislation was historic in lifting millions of people out of poverty and economic insecurity. And what we're seeing today is a rebound in poverty as those programs begin to expire or have already winded down.
Why isn't this set of policies politically popular enough to maintain, do you think?
I think one of the challenges we faced with the expanded child tax credit is that a lot of people didn't realize that it was a new style of a new program, in that it wasn't just another pandemic program. And so a lot of people didn't realize that this was a separate entity apart from the stimulus payments. And then I think the other challenge was around messaging. I think Democrats didn't do a sufficient enough job in taking credit for one of the largest expansions of the safety net for children and families in modern American history. You know, I wish the president Sessions and other Democrats, you know, had town halls and had, you know, primetime speeches talking about the success of this program. I mean, just within a couple of months from July 2021 to the end of 2021, you know, 3 million kids were lifted out of poverty just due to the expanded child tax credit. It was a remarkable piece of social policy that few people really understood and grappled with. And so I think we, you know, the consequence of that, the expiration of that, as a result of the fact that Senator Joe Manchin and 50 Senate Republicans refused to support the expansion, you know, we are in this dire situation today.
Before we get into one of those individual stories, Nikhil, on the policy we were just discussing, people will say, you know, those pandemic emergency policies may have been necessary, but they're unsustainable as permanent policy without running up the national debt so much. It would burden those same children of today with crushing economics as they come of age. Do you disagree?
You know, I would start by citing the National Academy study on child poverty. And the National Academy's found that the annual toll of child poverty ranges from $800 billion to $1.1 trillion. That is an extraordinary amount of money. And that costs all of us, whether you are poor, middle class, or wealthy. It costs us in the form of higher spending on public assistance programs, on higher crime, on higher social dislocation, on lower economic productivity. It hurts our economy and American democracy. And so, when we make these investments on the front end in children and families, we see extremely positive outcomes on the back end in terms of longer life expectancy, better health, better educational attainment, improved quality of life, among other things. The evidence is very clear based on decades and decades of research.
And critics will also say the pandemic spending, to the extent that the federal government did spend so much money, is also one of the causes of inflation right now, which is the main economic burden that many Americans are feeling at the moment, and also responding politically, perhaps to the advantage of Republicans. That happened in the congressional races in the New York suburbs last year, where that plus crime helped to flip Congress. Your thoughts on that?
You know, the notion around the pandemic programs increasing inflation is, you know, it's an important conversation to be had. I just want to be very clear that these pandemic programs prevented mass death and suffering. People are alive today and have families because those programs existed. So I think it's very important to at least acknowledge that situation. There are a number of causes of inflation. You know, economists have largely pointed to the supply shocks of a pandemic in creating inflation. And we have now seen inflation cooling down over the past year, thanks to a series of policies and the economic recovery. When we were trying to pass Build Back Better in 2021, one of the programs in that bill was a massive investment in pre-K and childcare, two programs that would have dramatically helped curtail inflation in this country by allowing parents, especially mothers, go into the labor force and stay in the labor force. So I think there's a number of policies that we can implement to bring down inflation even further and provide people with economic security. And then on the crime issue, I think Democrats need to talk seriously about crime, and particularly not just about crime as a kind of metaphysical, theoretical sense, but in the sense that people deserve to live in safe communities. People deserve to walk down the street and have no fear of getting shot or mugged or assaulted. And we have that means addressing the root causes of crime and delinquency by investing in programs and other services that address crime, particularly poverty, economic insecurity, lack of educational opportunity, and lack of summer and after school programs for our young people.
Now, this is a policy book, but largely it's a personal story book, as I mentioned before, and as you follow three children and their families from Philadelphia. In the op-ed, you focus on one of the three, Emmanuel Coriano. What made you choose him?
So in Live to See the Day, I followed three young people who grew up in the poorest neighborhood of Philadelphia, Kensington. And Kensington is an astonishing place, both in terms of social and economic inequality. To paint a little bit of a picture, it is the life expectancy for babies born in Kensington is 71, 17 fewer years than the babies born just 4 miles away in Society Hill, a wealthy white neighborhood. And the conditions in the neighborhood are incredible. The levels of poverty and incarceration and crime and other social ills. And I met three of these young people, Ryan, Emmanuel, and Giancarlos, when they started attending El Centro de Estudiantes, an alternative last chance high school in the neighborhood. And Emmanuel in particular has, just a very moving story. He was raised by a single disabled mother who subsided on supplemental security income, SSI, as well as temporary assistance for needy families, TANF, which yielded less than $10,000 a month. So they tried to live on that, and it meant that they had to endure evictions and housing insecurity, food insecurity, hunger, deep poverty, living in very violent, unsafe neighborhoods. Emmanuel had to endure enormous instability and insecurity in his life, while later on grappling with his sexual orientation. He eventually comes out to his mother as bisexual and has to maneuver a cruel, cruel society amid social depression and other issues. So in the book, I provide an intimate portrait of these young people, these lives, as well as an intergenerational account of their mothers, because I thought it was very important to show how the reproduction of poverty exists from one generation to another, and how the conditions that affected Emmanuel's mother, Yvette, are ones that also deeply are affecting his life in his childhood.
Right. So where's he at today? And do you know what policies he would support for kids who may be starting out life the way he did?
So Emmanuel now is known as Karem, using they, them pronouns. Remarkably, Karem is a staff member at El Centro de Estudiantes. They had tried community college for a couple semesters after graduating high school, and the burden of housing costs made it difficult for them to stay in school. So today, they're living in much greater economic security, which is, I think, really just I'm thrilled about their work and their career and their economic situation compared to what they were enduring in childhood. And in terms of policies, I talked to the kids often about policy. I'd ask them, if you had a magic wand, if you could wave a magic wand, what policies would you implement? And they talked about all the way from better funded schools, schools that had decent infrastructure. They talked about a greater level of SNAP benefits so they didn't have to be hungry so often at the end of the month. They talked about making sure that their neighborhoods weren't afflicted by gun violence, so gun safety measures. Other policies in terms of providing greater opportunities for higher education and life after high school. I think what they indicate is that we really need in this country a broad cradle-to-grave social safety net that strengthens American children and families and provides everyone with a decent standard of living and economic security.
Let's take a phone call. Terry in Queens. You're on WNYC. Yeah. Hi, Terry.
Yes, good. I would like to say basically that there should be some type of money that is given by the government for each individual who was born in this society, country. And also they should have food programs. Like if they have fast food restaurants. They should have food services and clothing services for people who are needy, and stop the city agencies should stop wrongfully terminating parents or people, or stop, you know, from their jobs. Because once a person is fired, the whole family and the whole community spirals into more poverty or deeper poverty. And I think there should be technical training for the new wave in technology, for free training for people who are in poverty, so they can have a chance to get jobs and on their feet. And as far as homelessness, you have a lot of people who have backyards and spaces that they're not using, that are just full with junk, and you can build a tiny little house on in their backyard and knock off some of the mortgage rates that they're paying, or use that as some type of tax write-off. And but have like a if a person is born, they have like a $10,000, $20,000 money that they get from the government based on whatever money they may have from their job, and it's just piled on top of that. And people can survive with more resources, money, and a place where they can get free clothing, free food, not just like clothes from different designers or different companies that make clothes, mm-hmm. like The Gap and so forth, and sneakers and shoes, so they can feel good about themselves, but also at the same time don't look like they're poor and desperate, because desperate people do desperate things to stay alive.
You've obviously thought about this a lot, Terry. And you told our screener you have some personal connection that led you to think so deeply about this issue. Do you want to share any of that?
Yes. I lost my job, wrongfully terminated. And New York City does not hire you if you're fired from New York City agency. You can't work for any other agency. So if I was wrongfully terminated based on a disability, and another agency can't pick me up, then I go into poverty. And then my children suffer. Child support is another situation where they just take so much money from the non-custodial parent or the father that he cannot survive. And it's and the money doesn't really go to the children. It goes to the system. So that's another agency that has to be reevaluated. And because it really doesn't help the kids, it hurts.
Terry, thank you for all of that. Obviously, a lot of people would push back on that last thought about men not paying their child support. But we're going to go on to another caller, Adam in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Hey, I love the show. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
I'm calling because when we were seven, my father left. There was no card, no check. He just took off. My mom had three kids. Literally lived on a dead-end street, and we needed programs like welfare, and we needed food stamps to get back on our feet. And it makes me really sad that people forget that we're just human beings trying to live and do what we can. All of us kids had jobs as teens. I had two jobs at 15, and we needed those programs. I really want people to understand that not everyone using these programs is just trying to take advantage of people. I think a lot of people take advantage of programs all over the place, including tax breaks for big corporations, but we're just human beings trying to survive. Thank you so much for talking about this subject.
Adam, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, Adam talks about his dad leaving when he was seven. There's another new book related to child poverty, getting some buzz right now. It's Melissa Kearney's new book called The Two-Parent Privilege. And as described by New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, it's the one privilege liberals ignore. That's the headline of his column on it. And he cites stats from the book, including families headed by single mothers are five times as likely to live in poverty as married couple families, and children in single mother homes are less likely to graduate from high school or earn a college degree. They're more likely to become single parents themselves, perpetuating the cycle, unquote. Have you read that book, or how much do you agree or disagree with its premise as one of the things that society needs to focus on if it's going to try to end child poverty?
I have not had a chance to read the book. I read the New York Times opinion piece based on the book, which was quite interesting. There is a thread in Kensington where many of the children who lived in poverty grew up in single parent households. I would be interested in dwelling less on that point and more so about what types of programs and policies would keep families together and strengthen those folks. I don't know if this writer mentions this, but it would be very powerful to have a universal child care program so that single mothers and fathers can enter the workforce and stay in the workforce without the fear of their children not having a safe place to be during the day. I'd be more interested in talking about the types of policies that would help families in whatever situation they might be in.
I played earlier a clip of Bernie Sanders, who you worked for when he was chair of the Senate Budget Committee, as an advisor on children and education. And I wonder about other countries as models. As we set up another Bernie Sanders clip here, here again is Bernie Sanders on CNN last week.
So, of course, we have to restore that child tax credit. We have to end this obscenity of how we treat our children. We have to deal with income and wealth inequality. We need health care. For these are not radical ideas. These are ideas that exist in many countries all over the world.
As we run out of time, we were talking about the pandemic national policies that are getting undone, which were so successful at reducing child poverty in this country. But I'm curious if you think, looking back, that the LBJ war on poverty, which might have been the most explicit attempt to end child poverty in this country, that goes all the way back to the 1960s, or any other longer-term policies that have been in effect, have worked or not worked?
It's a great question. There is a lot of evidence to show that the Great Society programs reduced poverty and economic insecurity, all the way from Medicare to Medicaid to the expansion of Social Security benefits to expansion of school meals. One of the challenges, though, is that the Great Society did not include a number of other important programs, and it too often relied on a premise that we can simply educate people out of poverty. I think we need a public jobs program that will provide everyone with decent public employment that is unionized and pays a living wage. And we've got to go much further in really developing and investing in public goods. And that means a public option in various sectors, a public option in childcare, in housing, in healthcare, in broadband. Because it's not simply enough to subsidize the private sector. We've got to build state capacity to deliver decent goods and benefits to families and communities. And, there's a lot of great work happening across this country. I'll give one example. In Illinois, the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, has recently announced a major initiative to bring grocery stores into food deserts. And that includes publicly owned grocery stores where municipalities and cities and towns can invest in their own grocery stores that provide more affordable, nutritious food for their residents. There's a lot that we can do on the front end in terms of building up the public sector that will reduce poverty, but also economic insecurity at large.
And there we will leave it with Nick Hill-Goyle, his important new release, Live to See the Day, Coming of Age in American Poverty. Thanks so much for sharing your book with us.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.